Thank you, members of the panel, Mr. Ortiz. In 1999, Mr. and Mrs. Campbell.
Excuse me, counsel, would you make entry?
James Lappin, I apologize. James Lappin and Julie Lappin appearing on behalf of the appellant David Campbell.
Thank you.
I apologize. In 1999, Mr. and Mrs. Campbell, both acting pro se, filed an action in the Douglas District Court to dissolve their marriage. As part and parcel of that process, they entered into a comprehensive settlement agreement called the separation agreement. It appears that they used the court-ordered JDF forms, and in that agreement, they resolved all issues. And most importantly, the issue that they resolved that is the subject of this litigation is the waiver of spousal maintenance, the mutual waiver of spousal maintenance, wherein each of them agreed that spousal maintenance was waived by them and would never be sought again. And those words are in bold in the separation agreement which they executed. That agreement, as part of the process, was presented to the trial court, who statutorily has to determine whether the separation agreement is unconscionable as to the parties. The court entered an order dissolving the marriage, entered a decree, and in that decree incorporated the separation agreement as part and parcel of the final orders. As such, the agreement between the parties became a final judgment. No post-trial motions were filed at that time, or any other time after that, until 2003 when this matter came up, and no appeals were filed. So at that point in time, the court having not retained jurisdiction, the parties having not asked the court to retain jurisdiction, the court had jurisdiction solely to do one thing in 1999, and that is to enforce any violation of the agreement between the parties. The court was divested of jurisdiction regarding all other matters, and notably divested of jurisdiction regarding any future issues to amend the separation agreement, and particularly to deal with issues of spousal maintenance, that issue having been waived by the parties. All of these facts were acknowledged by Judge Keshet.
Excuse me, I interrupt you just
absolutely
a little bit. Just there. Specifically, what is the basis for the court being divested of its jurisdiction to address maintenance at that time? I just want to know what the basis is that you're relying on.
Final judgment and the issue of spousal maintenance having been waived by the parties, the court retains jurisdiction solely by virtue of the act to enforce its order.
So you're saying the court cannot modify permanent orders in any respect after
that's
that
correct
point?
It becomes a final judgment, and only under Rule 59 or 60, assuming a timely motion is filed by the court, by the parties or by the court on its own motion, there's no ability to modify a property settlement agreement, and there's no ability by the court to modify its own order.
Mr. Lappin, let me ask you if there's any distinction here. Under statute, when a court addresses modification of maintenance, it's required to make certain findings and then come up with a maintenance order. And I'm not sure that's what happened in this case. What we had was a stipulation and a request just to adopt the stipulation as a court order. Is there any distinction with the court's authority to be able to do one and not the other?
No,
and if not, why?
It could do neither. So it couldn't be a motion to modify maintenance filed by one party, for example, over the objection of another party, because the court wouldn't have had jurisdiction to deal. It wouldn't have had subject matter jurisdiction regarding the issue of spousal maintenance after June 24, 1999, and the post-trial motion period having expired. What happened here is that nobody filed any motion to modify maintenance, so that kind of is an academic issue. What happened was that the parties filed a stipulation in 2003 in which Mr. Campbell agreed to pay contractual maintenance to Mrs. Campbell. He submitted that stipulation to the court. The court stamped that document and made it an order of court. Mr. Campbell then came forward and asked the court to terminate his maintenance obligation. And we argued to the court, which is the subject of this issue, and that the court didn't have jurisdiction to approve any stipulation of the parties. The court had lost its subject matter jurisdiction after June of 1999. The parties could not bestow subject matter jurisdiction by the filing of a stipulation with the trial court. Does that answer the question?
Well, I think if I can ask it again, is there a distinction between a claimed right, I'm filing a motion because I'm claiming a right to maintenance, and a contractual right, where you have two parties making an agreement, they create a contract, and does a court have authority to then enforce that contract as an order of the court?
I don't think there's any difference. I think that the court does not have subject matter jurisdiction, then it doesn't matter whether that comes up by a motion or by an agreement. As I was saying, all of these facts were acknowledged by Judge Cashette in his order of March 31, 2010, which is one of the two orders from which we seek this court's reversal. He acknowledged in his order that the court was divested of jurisdiction. He acknowledged in his order that there was a valid waiver by the parties. He acknowledged in his order that all of those things would have deprived the court of the power of judicial review.
And I'm still sort of thinking about that procedurally. I know these parties apparently in 2003 wanted to modify the permanent orders. And I understand you're saying that couldn't be done because there was no subject matter jurisdiction. But you say that the court retained jurisdiction to enforce the permanent orders. And if the parties had just taken a slightly different procedural tack and had come in and said, well, you know, we're having trouble enforcing, complying with these permanent orders because this situation under IRS is fraudulent, so could you please modify it into something different? At that point, the court has no authority to modify the permanent orders.
What situation under the IRS was fraudulent?
If that's apparently the claim, is that the original setup of the salary violated some IRS
statutes. Well, as to that issue, the court took no testimony, the court received no evidence, there's no record that we have, that you have, regarding these statements by the court.
Okay, but hypothetically, if the parties had come in and stipulated that their activities were in violation of some IRS statute, or they feared they were, could they not then, through the mechanism of enforcing the permanent order, saying, well, we fear that this is fraudulent, it needs to be changed?
I don't think they can.
So they're stuck with it.
Stuck with it. It's a final judgment. It's a final order. Just like a jury trial, just like a bench trial. And then you come in and you say, well, you know, the thing I argued for at the time it was fraudulent. We were under a mistake of fact, a mistake of law, and the agreements or evidence which we introduced, or the stipulation which we read into the record at the beginning of our case, we want out of that now. You have a final judgment. It's too late. You litigated your case. These parties litigated their case. They litigated it by agreement. And the court issued a decree. The court said, we approve your agreement. It ceases to become an agreement of the parties anymore. It's now a judgment. It's enforceable as a judgment. So if one party didn't comply, which is why I say the court retained jurisdiction to enforce its order, if there was non-compliance with the terms of the property settlement agreement, when the court retains jurisdiction under powers of contempt and other powers to enforce its order. But the court can't change the order. The parties can't change the order. And I think Judge Cashette, in his order of March 31, 2010, states that repeatedly. And then he says, well, the court reacquired the power of judicial review. It's not clear what he means by the term judicial review, but assuming that he means that we have the power to reacquire jurisdiction, because judicial review is a completely different concept, the only two cases that he cites in the entire paragraph dealing with reacquiring judicial review are the Lay case and the Irwin case. As to Lay, because Irwin is a completely different set of facts, as to Lay, That case is noticeably different from the Campbell case in three particular respects. The parties in LA agreed to pay spousal maintenance to one another, unlike the Campbell case where they did not. The parties in LA did not have a waiver of the claim of spousal maintenance, and it's clear that a court does retain jurisdiction, as I've said, when there's spousal maintenance agreed to modify its orders. The court retains jurisdiction. If you can prove that the terms of the order are unfair, and that's a substantial continuing change of circumstances, one party or the other can petition the court to modify the maintenance obligation. That's what happened in Lay. And in Lay, the court retained jurisdiction then to deal with that request to modify, unlike Campbell, where the parties waived spousal maintenance and said, never again will we come to court and request spousal maintenance. Now, so it's our position, if you look at the various cases that we cited, and we cited, I think, 8 or 9 cases, Horton, Ebel, Seawald, Stroud, Thomas, Vio, New, Butt, and Beatrice Foods. And those cases are not only from Colorado, but they include some substantial Colorado cases. Ebel made it through the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, I think, 3 times. Parties cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction on a court. Once the court loses its jurisdiction, it cannot be conferred by the parties. Ebel, Thomas, all those cases stand for that proposition, which is why I'm saying that the parties in this case, although they intended to ask the court to bless their document, which at that time was a contract, they asked the court to bless this contract and now make it an order of this court. They could not do so. That order was void ab initio. When the court stamped that order in 2003, it did not have the power to do so.
Mr. Lippin, let me ask you what your interpretation of 1410.122.1a is when it provides that, except as otherwise provided in section 1410.112.6, the provisions of any decree respecting maintenance may be modified. And it goes on only as to installments rather, accruing subsequent, etc. How does that statute affect the court's subject matter jurisdiction in this case, if at all?
Well, the issues that the court retains jurisdiction and the parties are issues of child custody, parenting time, child support, the payment of spousal maintenance when the court does retain jurisdiction. The parties are free in an agreement. Often happens that the parties will agree, for example, to pay contractual maintenance. And they say in that contractual maintenance, in the first instance, we do not give the court the power to modify our contractual maintenance. So 1410.122 says you can preclude the court's modification.
Well, the reverse is true. They came back in later and said we changed our mind. We've changed our mind.
What if you review the first waiver is taking away the court's decision-making ability about maintenance, but not the subject matter jurisdiction over the subject of maintenance, and having subject matter jurisdiction over the subject of maintenance, when the parties come in, they haven't violated the court's decision-making capabilities by asking them to do something different?
Well, I think they're one and the same. If you don't have jurisdiction over the maintenance, you can't have jurisdiction over the terms of the maintenance. And maybe I'm not understanding.
Well, I'm thinking you have jurisdiction over the maintenance, but by stipulating that there would be no maintenance, they take away the court's authority to order maintenance absent some other agreement.
Correct.
Okay. And so they don't take away the subject matter jurisdiction over the thing called maintenance. Well, they just take away the authority of the court to order it.
Well, the court couldn't order maintenance. The parties dealt with maintenance contractually. And contractually, they waived maintenance. So it's the same as having contractual maintenance that you pay. I agree to pay maintenance we agreed that the court cannot take away or modify my obligation to pay contractual maintenance. It's payable for a specific amount for a specific term. I can't come back, Mr. Campbell can't come back, the other party can't come back and say, we wanted to do that then, but we now changed our mind. They can't do it unilaterally, they can't do it together. Because the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction. So, Your Honor asked about 1410.122. You can preclude the court's maintaining of jurisdiction. You can limit jurisdiction by setting forth different standards of review. But here, the parties waived completely any claims for maintenance. At that point in time, the issue of maintenance was off the table, then and forever.
Thank you, Mr. Lappin. I see that your time is up. Thank you.
Good morning. Greg Ortiz, registration 32690, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Mrs. Campbell. There's a clause in the party separation agreement that starts this whole thing. And what it says is both parties waive, give up forever, maintenance. Once the court accepts a party's waiver, that party may never again seek maintenance. That's the whole question here. Was there a waiver of seeking maintenance, or was there a waiver of maintenance completely? Subject matter jurisdiction under Stroud says that you have a certain class of cases in which the court has jurisdiction over. That's a jurisdiction to determine the issue. So if the party waives maintenance, what they have done is they've waived the court's ability to determine that issue. It does not prevent the parties from seeking a mutual agreement to address that issue within their own. And that's what they did in this case.
Mr. Ortiz, so in response to your opposing counsel's argument that the court has no subject matter jurisdiction over the subject of maintenance, could you please give this court some authority that shows that distinction that you're making about jurisdiction for seeking maintenance versus the subject of maintenance?
Yes, in Lay versus Lay, the court talks about that and says that the parties can make an agreement at a later time. Let me give you an analogy. I understand Mr. Lappin addressed the court and said that the court cannot address any of those other issues once that agreement is entered. I disagree. Had the parties come before the court and said, we want to modify this property division, there is nothing that prevents the court from being able to do that. And we left out the maintenance completely and said, we're going to give Mrs. Campbell, instead of taking away all of her interest in this company, we're going to give her the entire company. The court had jurisdiction to do that because the parties came to them with a mutual agreement to say, this is what we're going to do. There is case law that says that you can't modify the property distribution. I agree with Mr. Lappin in that regard. However, the parties can still come back to the court and modify that property distribution. Well, spousal maintenance is no different. The parties can mutually come back to the court and say, yes, we waived the right to seek maintenance, which means that we're not going to file a court, neither of us will file a court individually, asking the court to either enter an order or modify the maintenance order. But we can still come back and mutually agree, contractually agree, to have maintenance. I think that is the difference.
Mr. Eppen. Analogizes this circumstance to a final judgment in a civil action other than a dissolution action, and argues that parties could not come back after a final judgment entered in a civil action and ask the court to modify its judgment. How do you respond to that analogy, and what's the difference here?
I think the difference here is in the class of cases in which you're referring to. In a civil case, you have a dispute with a certain time and end to it. In a domestic case, you have a case that has a life within its own, which could be the life of the children, if it's a custody issue, could be the life of the parties, if it's a maintenance issue, could be the life of the parties, if it's a property issue. All of those fit within the class of action in which it is before the court. Does that address your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that What happens in this particular case is both parties come to the court and say, you know what, Your Honor, this isn't working for us, as the court has pointed out. And so our agreement in regards to the distribution of property doesn't work. Pursuant to 1410.114, you have to look at the distribution of property and the income that results from that distribution before you can go on to address spousal maintenance. That's what a court does. In this particular case, they redistributed the property. Nobody disputes that. Mr. Campbell doesn't even dispute that. He is not here appealing the property distribution. He's here appealing just the maintenance portion of that. Although if you take the argument that Mr. Lavin said that nothing, that it's a final judgment and nothing can be modified, you would think that both issues would be before the court, but they're not.
So, geez, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
How do you harmonize John? Six, which says, except for terms concerning the support, the allocation of decision-making responsibilities, or parenting time of children, the decree may expressly preclude or limit modification of terms set forth in the decree if the separation agreement so provides. And how do you harmonize your position with that statutory
provision? And that's exactly it, because of that statement that is made in the very beginning. What that statement says is, once the court accepts a party's waiver, that party may never again seek maintenance. So in this particular case, it's not a party seeking maintenance. It's the parties entering a mutual agreement. So by saying that under 1410.112 it's held, in this particular case it doesn't apply because this is not what the parties did. The parties came as a mutual agreement and mutually determined spousal maintenance. Not one party came to the court and sought maintenance. Okay. If there's any question as to the language of the agreement or language of law, I think that you should look at it from the plain language. And the plain language says a party may not seek maintenance. And that's not the case before you.
Mr. Ortiz, I understand mm-hmm. that a party was not seeking maintenance and that there was a mutual agreement mm-hmm. to create a maintenance order where there previously was none, but that agreement had the effect of modifying the court's previous order. And so my concern is the preclusion of taking away the ability to modify a previous order, or is it just taking away the ability of the party to request something? And I know we keep coming back to it, but my concern is the effect of this really is to modify a court's order.
I don't think in a domestic case, I think that those orders are ongoing. They're in flow. They're very fluid. We have children that are growing, changing, incomes that are changing, support issues that come up, property that was generated through the marital estate. All of that, I think, in a domestic case makes it such that a court's order in a domestic case needs to be fluid and grow and evolve as the case transpires over time. I don't think that you can look at a separation agreement and say that that will never change. I don't think that when you're dealing with a family in a domestic case, that you can say that separation agreement or that court order or that permanent order or that judgment is final, never to be reviewed again. I think that this particular case expresses that. If you look at the property distribution again, they made an agreement there that changed that property distribution, but that's not before you, so that shows that it's okay to do that. By Mr. Campbell's own actions, he would agree to that. He paid maintenance for 5 years after ending this agreement. He paid it monthly, just like every month he was supposed to. Even after filing his motion, he paid it for another 3 months, acknowledging that there was a valid contract there. It was only after that the response was filed that he stopped paying that. I don't know why he stopped paying that. I could only speculate, and I won't do so. But there was a period of time of even after filing the motion in which he said, I have an obligation and I pay it. So that shows that even by his own actions, he took the benefits of the business, of having sole ownership of the business, and he took on the responsibilities of that bargain for exchange that the parties entered in July of 2009. And so as a result of that, he had both sides of that. And he acknowledged through that that a separation agreement or a final order or a court's judgment can be modified by the parties. Does that address?
Does his acknowledgement, or what you call acknowledgement or recognition of the ability to modify the court's order matter? I mean, does the party's acknowledgement or understanding of that matter if the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction in the first place?
I would agree with that statement, that it probably doesn't matter whether his actions do that or not. However, then you look at the arguments of estoppel, but then on top of that, you look at the fact that this isn't, and this is where I come back to that subject matter argument, this is the court had, what they did is they waived the right of the court to determine the issue. They did not waive the right of the parties to agree the issue. And that's what they did. They made an agreement on the issue. They determined the issue on their own. So I think that it does, in answer to your question, it does limit the enforceability of that if somebody had gone to the court, filed a motion, and the court entered an order that said, here, I'm going to modify the maintenance based upon this redistribution of the property. But that's not what happened. The parties made a mutual agreement to redistribute that property and enter an agreement for contractual or non-modifiable spousal maintenance. Okay. In regards to the last argument on appeal is the evidentiary issue, whether the court can enter a judgment based upon there not being a hearing. So 121 tells the parties that the court can enter its order based upon the motion. The facts, as pointed out in the answer brief, the facts before the court that the court had in its finding in its March 31st, 2010 order were all within the record. There was a response filed. None of the allegations or averments within that response were objected to in a reply. Sworn financial affidavit was consistent with Ms. Campbell earning the income from the business. And in fact, in the party's own stipulation in July of 2009, they addressed the fact specifically that as a result of selling the business, as a result of her losing her income, they are going to enter this agreement for spousal maintenance. So I think that lays the foundation for the court to make its findings in which it did so. In regards to your argument for attorney's fees, I think that this is a case in which there's no factual or legal basis behind this because the parties are not, the parties only had a waiver of subject matter jurisdiction for the court to determine the issue, not for them to agree upon that. And then Mr. Campbell, in fact, fulfilled his obligations and responsibilities and took the benefit from that. It was only after a period of time, and who knows what instigated that, in which now he's coming back and wanting to take away the responsibility, but he says nothing of the benefit he's receiving by having that business to himself. So as a result of that, I ask for, there's no factual legal basis for this and appeal, and ask for attorney's fees for Ms. Campbell as a result. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you for your arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.